Good evening, you all. I'm Kilowatt 2, Kilo... I'm claiming Mel's call letters already. I'm Kilo 2, Romeo, India, Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll also be hearing Kilo Echo Yankee. His name is Mel. And Mel and Dick attempt to host this thing called the Technical Net, in which amateurs gather to discuss their favorite subject. What you're listening to tonight are the, I guess, the geek techies that are not watching Academy Awards. Somewhere in the world, there are people who don't watch the Academy Awards. They really like ham radio. Let me drop. And so, Mel and Dick, or at least I claim that this is the brand new Technical Net, which means that for those who sign in during the first hour, we make a sincere attempt to answer everyone's question at least briefly. In other words, in theory, no one has to wait for more than an hour, worst case, to get at least a brief beginning of his answer. In the old days, there were times when people had to wait longer than an hour, and of course that wasn't comfortable for them. And then at the end of that hour, Mel opens his mailbag for the people who are getting their ham radio license, don't yet have a chance to get on and talk to us live. And so we answer a few of those questions. Then, from then on, after the space report from Paul, WS2N, if there is one, then we then get into the deeper subjects. For those who have been listening to the TechNet, let me drop. For the last few months, you'll know that we've been getting rather deep into the physics of some of the basics of how radio works. How does a magnetic field work? Where does an electrostatic field come from? What's going on at the molecular level? Yes, we know that this doesn't please everyone, but I say that inside of a true ham radio operator, there is a kind of a scientist that wants to know what's going on. I, for one, have learned an awful lot in this process. None of us claim to be experts in this area. We're babes in the woods, helping each other, leading each other through the darkness, and hopefully finding some light as to what Mother Nature is really telling us, because we think we want to know. One other set of subjects I think we should discuss tonight is that if you've been reading some of the reports, particularly in Newsday, among other places, and a number of other technical journals, there was a recent report done by the National Institutes of Health and also by the Brookhaven National Laboratory, which took 47 volunteers from Long Island who were being subjected to a PET scan, positron emission tomography, and at the same time, they volunteered to wear a cell phone, and the cell phone was used for a 50-minute period of time, to find out what reaction. Let me drop. And this report that has been variously reported either in sensational manners or non-sensational manners, set increase in glucose metabolism of the portion of the brain of the subjects that was on the side of the head where the cell phones are there. And so I've been getting lots of letters and phone calls this week from people asking, what does this mean? Beyond the first hour, we'll do a little bit of a discussion of that. Also, there's one other incident that occurred this week. A good friend of mine who teaches at the graduate level, teaches electrical engineering, RF engineering design practices at the Brooklyn Poly Institute, at least that's what it used to be called, in Brooklyn. He had an encounter with his students last Friday with reference to ham radio, which turned out to be quite striking. I'll give you a few words on that. Okay, one other thing is that I have a fairly important meeting I have to go to tomorrow, so I will have to quit. You guys can continue beyond midnight if you want to, but I will have to quit at midnight sharp tonight in order to get ready for tomorrow. Now, the way a person, let me drop.
Before we start, I have to have some information, very important.
Go right ahead, Mel.
I've been inundated with emails, and even on this morning 10-meter net, the question basically has been about two or three questions, and I've gotten a lot of emails, to say the least. Is this an open repeater, or yes or no? Simple question.
Okay, I've had it from very good authority, from the officers of the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club, and I should have mentioned that earlier. The Technical Net is advertised as being thoroughly open. The net itself and all who join it during the hours of the net on Sunday night is thoroughly open to all properly licensed radio amateurs. no matter where they live, no matter what club they're a member of, no matter what their faith, creed, color, whatever. It's open to all properly licensed radio amateurs for at least this net, if not others. So with reference to this net, there is no controversy. There have been discussions on, at other times, is this particular repeater thoroughly open? I won't get into the politics of that. And by the way, some of the reports that I've been getting is that people say they like the technical net, but please try to avoid the politics. And we're going to try to do that. We're not going to get into politics during the net. This net is intended for the, as I called it before, the geek techies, the kind of guys that think that discussing ham radio and the nitty-gritty of it, of antennas and transmitters and receivers and transmission lines and propagation, all that kind of jazz. Those people think that that's more important than the Academy Awards or a World Series or the Super Bowl or whatever. So answer your question, Mel. Thoroughly open during this net, if not other nets. K2KEY for any other comments. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Hey, the other question was that the disposition of this repeater, other than the TechNet, is it an open repeater? I guess you can't answer that. And the second question, or the part B of that is the number of the people that are associated with Limark. I've gotten a couple of reports, have said that if you are not on the roster and you use the repeater on a regular basis, you will be subject to disciplinary action by the FCC. And, in fact, one person said to me, a young person, but it seems to be that I had a call letter I can go by, says that somebody told him that they can have his ham license revoked. So I don't want to get into the politics of it, but I just want to clarify it. If there's any way to clarify that's the bottom line, because I don't know how to answer these emails over.
K2KND.
Okay, we're about to get an extremely authoritative answer by the president of the club, Rich himself, K2KND. Go right ahead, Rich.
All right, thank you, Dick. Mel, the answer to the question, and Dick, the answer to the question is this. What determines what we are is our bylaws. The fact that in the ARRL directory it might say that we're open, that's an error. Just as if a error was made and someone said, well, now you have to change your telephone number to that number. It's an error. It's something that we did not realize. We finally caught up to it. And it will be corrected, if not in this directory, but in the next directory. The Limark repeaters are club repeaters. And in our bylaws, it says club repeaters, it says that our repeaters shall be owned, operated, and maintained owned, operated, and maintained by Limark for members. And that's what it is. It's a membership organization. We have a fairly substantial operating budget. And in all fairness, if people use the repeater on a regular basis, they should share in that expense. Let me let it drop.
How about EchoLink?
Now, that's part of the problem, is that people just... This is a different world. This is a world of EchoLink and IRLP. It's new to us, and we will figure out some policy, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about people that are in the immediate vicinity using the repeater. Our operating budget is approximately $21,000 a year. If you're going to use the repeaters, and the reason why we have that operating budget is that we chose to rent a site that gave us the coverage that we have that enables all of you to enjoy the benefits of this TechNet. But that site costs us a lot of money. And therefore, those who use it on a regular basis should share in the cost. And Mel, the answer to NETS is we welcome everyone using and participating in the NET. We welcome that because we hope that people will understand the kind of job that we're trying to do as a club and at some point say, well, you know what, I'd like to support that club. We have almost, this year we could hit 400 members, and perhaps half of them never come to the repeater, but participate and support us. And Dick, I hope that kind of answers the question. Next, everyone is welcome. Regular use of the repeaters, we want you to be a member. Dick?
for that clarification, Rich. John, I wonder if you had a further comment. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Thank you, Dick. No, Richie covered it perfectly. That's what I was going to tell you. I thought that was the way it was. All right. Back to you, Dick.
And, Dick, if I could add one other thing, please.
You got it, John. Now, Rich.
As Limark, and I've been president now for, this is my fourth year, I take a lot of criticism, but I think most people tell you that, you know, we listen. We really do try to listen, and we do to try. We do not try to change if it's something that really needs changing. But sometimes people back us up to a wall, and sometimes people will ask a question, and we answer the question, and that's not the answer that they want to hear. There are people that question whether there is any penalty. Yes, the FCC states, and you can look it up, and I'm doing it off the top of my head, it's part 97, either 205E or 207E, and it says specifically that repeater operators can limit those who use the repeaters. And that's the law. And the FCC will honor a repeater operator's request that they have asked someone to leave the repeater who does not do it, and the FCC will send the person a note that they are in violation. That is the right of the repeater operator. And furthermore, the FCC has clarified and said that because it costs money to operate some repeaters, it's perfectly okay for repeaters, for whatever the reason, to charge some dues. And that's coming directly from the FCC. Nobody that I know of has ever been told that they will be thrown off the repeater. But people have asked what the law is, and I've explained it to them, and then they took that as a threat when all I did was answer the question. Dick, this is K2KND.
Question.
I would avoid that at this point. I've explained the point. It doesn't make any sense to discuss it any further.
Well, I have a right to give the question. My question is, if I log through the ARP or Echolink, at that point, because I'm in the vicinity of the Echolink of the repeater, I'm not supposed to use the repeater if I'm not a club member. But other people logging through Echolink will not be punished. Isn't that strange? And to explain,
Dick, this is your net, and it doesn't make sense to go there. I've explained this, and I've explain the rules, and it's your net. So, back to net control. This is K2KND.
Ham radio is a hobby, and a person in his right mind enters a hobby for pure pleasure. Rarely does a person enter a hobby because he likes controversy or he wants to make other people unhappy. My recommendation in all of these situations is that we back off a little bit, take a deep breath, try to go easy with each other, except for the fact that lately I've been ending the net way beyond midnight, and tonight I'm not going to be able to do that. I usually end the net with the words, be kind to each other. I'm really serious about that. This is supposed to be a pleasurable hobby. If we get into the nitty-gritty of, you said, I believe, the interpretation is, the law is, the FCC said, and so on. We get into the nitty-gritty of that. Like any other politics, religion, or whatever, you're always going to find disagreements. That's a given. Therefore, we should try not to go there. Try to treat each other with respect. It's supposed to be a fun hobby. Let's emphasize the fun portion of it. Okay, a person is going to sign into the technical net because he has a technical question. And we're going to try very hard to answer all of those questions, at least briefly, in the first hour. You sign in by giving us your call letters, your name, because I'm so darn forgetful, followed by the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Unless we have absolutely nobody sign in, there's no requirement to sign in to say, yes, I'm listening. After 28 years in the tri-state area, we sort of accept the fact that somebody is listening and the net still exists. There apparently is some enthusiasm for what it does. We don't claim to be experts in everything. We sometimes make errors. But slowly we find out about those errors. we correct them, we help each other out. There's a lot of brain power in the New York City area. We try to tap into that brain power, into the New Jersey, New York, Connecticut.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And there's an example of what we shouldn't be doing, talking beyond 1.5 minutes or so without taking a breath, a breather. So please sign in right now with your call letter's name and the word yes if you do have a question or a comment. If you're one of those rare individuals that's not watching the Academy Awards, give us your call letter's name right now with that yes, K2RIW and the TechNet listening.
K2YO, Bernie, yes.
KO2, okay. Bennett, yes. KC2ER, yes.
Okay, we got Bernie, Bennett, and it sounded like KC2ER, Kilo Charlie 2 Echo Romeo is what it sounded like very rapidly. Please correct me on those call letters. Please tell me your name, sir.
KC2ERR, name Angel.
We got you that time, Angel. So we got Bernie, Bennett, and Angel. Anyone else to sign in with a question or a comment, please give us your call letter's name and the word yes right now. K2RIW listening.
N2GOT, Howard.
WS2N, standing by. No space report planned, but I'll be listening in case you have any questions or comments about that, Dick.
Very fine, Paul. And Howard, we got you. But before Howard, there was an extremely weak station. I'll try one more time. Sounds like KB2VD something. Want to give it another try? You were extremely weak. Okay, that signal was 95% noise, 5% audio. I think I heard Kilo Bravo 2 Victor Baker something. So you're the 1, 2, 3, you're the fourth person on the list. If there's something you can do between now and we get to you, we'll make a sincere attempt to have a conversation, to hear your technical question. Bernie, when you get a chance, I'm going to say some words with reference to feeding an antenna from one end with or without a stub, so to speak, and why a stub is required. But I know that may not be your question tonight. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2RIW, you got it, Bernie.
Good evening, Dick and the net. No, that's not my question, but boy, I definitely want to hear more about that. As you know, that's a subject that I'm very interested in and want to do some experimenting in. My question now, it's in the world of VHF, UHF. The difference in a quarter wave ground plane antenna and a 5/8 wave ground plane antenna. What's the, first off, how much gain can I expect by going from quarter wave to 5/8 wave? And also, what's the magic of 5/8? Why is it 5/8 instead of half or 3/4 or something like that? So if you could spend 90 seconds on that, just to kind of point me in the right direction, please.
Good question, Bernie. I'm going to first start off with a dipole and show you how it relates to a so-called quarter wave ground plane. Assume I've got a dipole in free space. I know that some people are going to be hearing this for the fourth time, going to be a little bit bored, but it won't take very long. Got a full dipole in free space, half-wave dipole, set in the middle with a balanced transmission line, something like twin lead, and I'm doing this right outside the space shuttle, if you know what I mean. There's no ground nearby, and I'm suspended 200 meters away from the space shuttle when I'm doing this experiment. At one instant of time, the right-hand side of the dipole is positive, the next-hand side of the dipole is negative. And if I put a sheet of metal down the middle of the dipole, a sheet of metal at right angles, right in the center, because there is a neutral plane in the center, the presence of the sheet of metal makes no difference. No change in the pattern, no change in the gain, no change in the impedance. Now if I decide to use the sheet of metal and the right-hand side of the dipole only, the left-hand side of the dipole is still there electronically. It's there as a mirror image. When I do that, that's a ground plane antenna. I take this horizontal dipole with a sheet of metal. I only build the right-hand side. I rotate it 90 degrees so that the sheet of metal is now parallel to the ground, and that's my quarter-wave ground plane antenna. Electronically, it has many of the properties of a half-wave antenna. but a quarter wave antenna. You're feeding it in the center with the impedance for the full dipole was something like 72 ohms. It's now going to be something like 35, 36 ohms when you feed only half of it. Let me drop. And if you go to the so-called Brown and Woodward curves, which are available on that website, amateurradio.tv, where all of these technets for the last 5.5 years are recorded and documented by an extremely enthusiastic man named Mike Perry, KC2NJI. He's been doing this heroic effort for 5.5 years for this particular technet alone. And there you'll find a set of curves where if you know the length of your monopole antenna and you know its diameter, you can find out from that set of curves the exact impedance, the exact reactance, everything you want to know. Brown and Woodward spent a man year gathering that data way back in 1948, 47, when there was no network analyzer. They had to do it the hard way. So when you slowly take the antenna and make it very, very short, way below a quarter wavelength. Let me drop. Those curves will tell you that the resistive component is extremely small, maybe 1 ohm. The reactive component, capacitor reactance, will be extremely high, maybe 3,000 ohms. And if you've got the right impedance matching network, in other words, an antenna tuner with enough range, you can match that extremely short antenna, the so-called infinitesimal dipole. In this case, it's infinitesimal monopole. Krauss's book on antennas describes this, and you can get full performance out of that. It's hard to believe. As you slowly raise that to a quarter wavelength, the impedance goes through a kind of resonance. That really means the reactive component disappears, and you're left with 35 ohms. If you keep extending it, as you go to a full half wavelength of length, and you're feeding it from the bottom side, that 35 ohms slowly raises itself up to about 1,000 or 1,500 ohms of resistive component, and you go through another kind of resonance. You go through quarter wave resonance or half wave resonance. And when you feed it from the bottom and it's a half wave vertical object, the good news is you're feeding the very high impedance point. That means very little current is required. Yes, you've got to have an impedance step-up network to do that, but now the magnitude of the ground plane required, the counterpoise to give you good performance, is drastically decreased because the current is so small. Ordinarily, when you're launching a lot of current into the dipole like you do when it's a quarter wavelength long, you've got to be standing on somewhere that you're drawing the current from to issue the current into the antenna. That's the so-called counterpoise. And I've given the example of Arnold Schwarzenegger pushing on a weight in space to give you an example of what that means. As you make the dipole longer than half wave, where again it goes through resonance, the reactive component goes through zero a second time, the resistor component now is about 1,500 ohms. Let me drop. And you extend it further. Now the antenna becomes inductive, and the inductive reactance will increase until you hit the three-quarter wavelength point. But as you're going from quarter wave to half wave to three-quarter wave, the pattern is changing. And so if you're trying to squirt a signal out at the horizon, the pattern then moves such a way that as you're extending it from infinitesimal all the way through half wave and beyond, the amount of signal on the horizon continuously increases. In other words, where it's squirting the energy is being moved around in space, and the energy on the horizon continues to increase up until the 5/8 wave point. When you go beyond 5/8 wave, you start developing multiple lobes in space, but the particular lobe you care about, the one on the horizon, starts going back down. So that's the magic of 5/8 if you have an extremely large ground plane. Well, the roof of my car, when I've got a 2-meter mag mount antenna there, is not an infinite ground plane. I don't get all of that performance. However, half wave or 5/8 wave, the difference between the two is extremely minor. But because you're feeding very little current into it, the simple piece of plastic between the bottom of the antenna, the mag mount, and the rest of the car is giving you the exact same performance if you drilled a hole in the sheet metal and really mounted the antenna there and properly grounded the shield of the transmission line there. You'd have almost no difference in performance between half wave and 5/8 wave. So don't worry about that one. You do get a definite increase in performance when you go from quarter wave to half wave near the 5/8 region on a automobile for two reasons. Let me drop. Number one, the impedance, the resistive component in the impedance is increasing. Therefore, the need for the ground plane is decreasing. Second of all, the center of radiation, the high current point, is moving higher in the air. As you know on VHF, what makes an antenna work well? Three things. They're all called altitude. The higher you put the antenna on VHF, the more it clears the trees, the local horizon, the buildings and whatever, the more performance you're going to get. The biggest performance you get when you go from quarter wave ground plane mag mount on your car to half wave, the biggest performance increase is the rise in the phase center of radiation. The signal looks like it's coming from a higher number of feet above the ground. There's a small change in the pattern, a dB or so, nothing huge, but that raise in altitude, depending on the terrain where you are, can easily give you multiple dBs of improvement. So if you've got the ability to put half wave or 5/8 mag mount on your car with a big enough magnet and a springy enough thing so that every time you hit a garage door or a tree or whatever, it's not going to be knocked off the car, there's a definite benefit to be had. Maybe that answers some of the questions, now, Bernie. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Absolutely. That answers the question of what's magical about 5/8. I just made a note to go look up the Brown and Schwartz curves and do some more research on that. This does beg a slight follow-up question. The diameter of a UHF or VHF antenna, on HF, the larger the diameter of the radiators, the larger the frequency response of the antenna. I'm assuming that's also true in UHF or VHF, but does it really matter? A typical, say, Larson antenna is 100 thousandths in diameter. If I have a radiator that's 50 thousandths in diameter, am I going to notice a real difference between those two?
Hey, Bernie. The curves that I'm talking about are called Brown and Woodward. Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward made those curves in 1947-48. They're called the Brown and Schwartz. Usually the really smart people have a name like that. These particular guys are Brown and Woodward. And the nice thing about the Brown and Woodward curves is that every reasonable length of antenna, every reasonable diameter of antenna, is plotted on those curves. As you increase the diameter of the antenna, the bandwidth does increase very slowly at first. If I start off with a radiating section that is 1/1000th of a wavelength in diameter, and I make it 500th of a wavelength, and 100th of a wavelength, and 50th of a wavelength, there's an extremely slow increase in bandwidth. Until you start getting to the point of, let me pick a number, a 1/16th or 1/8th of a wavelength in diameter, the amount of increase in bandwidth, the amount of change in radiation impedance, is relatively slow. You'll find that out when you see those set of curves. So in the case of a mag mount antenna for 2 meters on your automobile or on the top of your tower, the diameter of the radiating section, 99% of the time, a guy selects that for mechanical reasons and weatherproofing reasons and wind survival reasons. Rarely does a person do that because he wants more bandwidth. There are other techniques by which you can get more bandwidth out of the antenna, but making it out of a very fat piece of copper pipe as opposed to a would-be piece of stainless steel, the difference in bandwidth will be relatively small, and in either case, the antenna can easily cover 144 to 148. That extra bandwidth that you might be looking for would be appropriate if you wanted the antenna to cover 100 to 200 megs, but I think that's not your requirement, Bernie. Over to you, Bernie, for a final, and then we got to move on. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Exactly what I needed, Dick. Thank you. Sorry for the mistake on the Brown and Schwartz. I think they're either tool makers or wrote musicals. But anyway, it's Brown and Woodward. I will look them up. Thank you, sir. On with the net. Oh, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, when you go to amateurradio.tangovictor, www.amateurradio.tangovictor, you'll see all of these recordings for the technical net for the last 5.5 years. You'll also see the so-called K2RIW Yagi feeding curves or something like that, it's calling it. And so there's an article there where I've got 1,500 words telling you how to make perfect impedance match of any dipole or monopole you're ever going to build. I mean, if you got the right kind of instrumentation, where you could resolve 1.001:1 standing wave ratio, or 35 decibels of reflection coefficient. If you've got the right instrumentation, that you can resolve that. Those curves and that article will tell you exactly how to get there. It is so extremely simple that once you understand it, it'll take a little bit of study, but once you understand it, a high percentage of the people who read that say, why in the world hasn't someone told me this sooner? I've needed this information. I built the Super Yagi, but the driven element was always a high visoir, and it's a very simple technique to make the driven element of your Yagi, your dipole, your monopole, any dipole-like or monopole-like antenna you build. If you want to, it's an extremely simple procedure to make the impedance at least at one frequency, as perfect as you can resolve with your instrumentation. And when you find out how easy it is, you're going to say, wow. And it's going to give you a great understanding of what's really going on, in my opinion. Okay, Bennett's next. KO2, okay. What would you like to talk about tonight, Bennett? K2LIW. My name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick. This is KO2OK. I'm in New Jersey. And I do have a quick question. I hope it won't take much of your time. I know you have followed in the past VHF and amplifiers and operation in the VHF region. And I'm curious if you followed the recent introductions of what people are calling the loop-fed array Yagis. So instead of a regular dipole at the feed point, they use a rectangular loop, and what you thought of those new style antennas in terms of overall performance. I know they're supposed to be lower noise and maybe wider bandwidth, but there's been a lot of talk recently, and a couple of local U.S. antenna makers have been coming out with them recently. Any thoughts, Dick? Back to you.
Yes, Bennett, lots of thoughts. And for the guys who are on VHF on 2-meter sideband, 432 sideband, 1296, 2304, 10 gigs, this exact subject has been discussed for at least 15 years, if not longer. If I was building a Yagi on 1296, for instance, I could make each of the individual elements out of ordinary dipole-like elements. And if I did that, I would find that a significant number of days in the year, I'd wake up in the morning, a lot of dew would happen the night before. There would be droplets of water on the tips of the individual dipoles and directors, and those drops of water would be adding a lot of capacitance to the ends of those elements. Each of the elements would now be tuned to a much lower frequency because of the droplets of water, and quite often that Yagi will fire in the reverse direction as a result. It'll aim the Yagi to the north. It normally has 15 dB of gain to the north. And now you find out that the stronger signal come off that Yagi is off the back because of the droplets of water. Therefore, if I make the loops, if I make the individual elements out of loops instead of dipole-like elements, let me drop. The water now gathers at the center near the boom where they're mounted. There, the water droplets have essentially no effect, and water doesn't gather on the vertical sides. So when it comes to ice and water and all other kinds of weather-like characteristics, a loop Yagi has a huge improvement when it comes to UHF and above frequency ranges. Now, the next question, the inadvertent question you're asking, Bennett, what is a Yagi? And having set up a ratiometry antenna range in my backyard where I could resolve a 20th of a dB of gain improvement. And that was the antenna range in which the RIW-19 Yagi was developed. I mean, when you can resolve that kind of a small gain improvement every time you change the position or length of a director, it's like a blind man or a sight-impaired man walking up a hill. You know which direction to go as long as your instrumentation is high enough in resolution and repeatable enough in performance. Then tuning a Yagi becomes a real fun-type project. In the process of doing that, I rediscovered what a Yagi really is. A Yagi is a number of resonators, you and I call them directors. Each resonator has a particular reactance at your operating frequency, and it's located at a particular position along the boom. So what makes a Yagi work? Where is all that directivity and all that gain is coming from? It's a series of reactances at particular positions along the boom. And now, let me drop. You as an antenna designer, have a large number of choices as to how you make that reactance at that position. You can make that reactance in a dipole-like manner with a straight piece of wire or a straight piece of tubing. You can make it in a circular manner. You can make it with triangles, with squares. You can do it with the initials of your name as the way you bend the wire at each one of those positions, as long as for the polarization at which your driven element is exciting that antenna array, that Yagi-like structure, and as long as within that polarization at that position, the resonance characteristic of your object that you put there has the right amount of reactance, you will get all of the focusing. What a dipole, what a Yagi really is, it's a synthesized slow wave structure. That means the signal flowing down the boom, going through all those elements, because of their capacitive reactance, because they're all tuned a little bit high, the signal flows through there a little bit more slowly than it does for a signal a little bit further away from the boom flowing down the Yagi. That's exactly what a magnifying glass does. When that sunlight is shining through your magnifying glass, and you're focusing it on the newspaper, and you're going to make a bright spot, and you're going to burn a hole in the newspaper, the sunlight shining through the center of your magnifying glass is going through a thicker piece of glass, and it moves more slowly. The portions of the sunlight going through the outer perimeter of your magnifying glass doesn't get slowed down as much. That is where the focusing action happens. That's what a Yagi does. It's a synthesized structure. Your eye doesn't see it. It electronically is a magnifying glass. So you can make them out of any shape, any diameter, or whatever you want. Yes, when you make loops instead of dipoles, you do get a little bit more bandwidth. But now we're talking about bandwidth of the individual resonators. Let me drop. However, the rate at which the reactance of each of those resonators changes as you sweep in frequency, and whether or not you're still continuing to meet the right amount of reactance at the right position in order to get all of that focusing. And let me give you one other example. It'll give you a little bit more of a hint. Say, for instance, I've got a beautiful 12-element Yagi, and I love the performance, but I wanted to have more gain. So I slap on some more boom length, and I slap on some more directors out in front. Instead of the 12-element Yagi, I make it a 14, a 16, or an 18-element Yagi. Common sense would lead you to believe I'm going to get more gain. Not necessarily true. You go through the real tuning procedure with a real good antenna range that can resolve small gain improvements, you'll discover that as you make the Yagi longer, every one of those directors gets a little bit higher in their tuned frequency, a little bit more in their reactance. What you're doing is you're building a magnifying glass with a longer focal length. Now that greater length of boom, you want it to act like a slightly larger magnifying glass with a longer focal length, so it still brings all of those radio waves from space in that great big diameter it captures, way beyond the length of your elements, by the way. You want to focus that all onto the driven element. So when you make a Yagi, when you make a Yagi array longer, if you're doing a good job, you're going to retune all of the elements to get that extra focal length in order to make it all give you the performance you should have. Every time you double the boom length of a well-tuned Yagi, you'll get approximately 3 dB more gain. The Gunter Hawk formula, Delta Lima 6 Whiskey Uniform, once you find that formula, Google that word, Delta Lima 6 Whiskey Uniform and Yagi Predicting Formula. You'll find Gunter Hawk's formula that for your length of boom, his formula will tell you exactly what gain you're going to get to the nearest couple of tenths of a dB if you do a good job of tuning. Length is...
repeater, timeout, cancel.
Length is gained, and the number of elements you put along that length is not necessarily dictated. So-called wide spacing and narrow spacing, minor perturbation if you've got good tuning procedures. I know it's a little bit more than you asked for, but maybe it helps, Bennett. KO2 OK, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, yeah, it does help. And maybe I need to just maybe clarify. My question is simply on a typical, let's say I'm interested in 6 meters. So I have a 6 meter Yagi. It's a typical dipole-fed driven Yagi, but now there are some Yagis out there that are using a loop for the driven element. Not a loop on the rest of the elements, just the driven element. And I just wanted to see if you've seen some of those new style, what are considered new style antennas here anyway, such as by Force 12 and others, and their performance versus the dipole fed typical Yagi. Back to you, Dick.
Dr. Wayne Oberbeck, KA6KL6YNB or something like that was his call letters. He used to live in the Los Angeles area of California. He came out with the square loop Yagi Quaggy antenna, roughly 1976-77. And Dr. Wayne Oberbeck appeared in competition with me at the East Coast VHF Society in 1977 with his square loop Yagi. And that just happened to be the exact same year I came out with the RIW-19 insulated Yagi. His belief was that the square driven element and reflector structure with the rest of the elements being normal dipole-like structures gave you greater gain because it was a more substantial reflection structure and whatever. It didn't give more performance. That particular Yagi design that Wayne first came out with was very appropriate for California, which is a very dry, desert-like area near Los Angeles, particularly in the Antelope Valley, which is northeast of Los Angeles, where very often it doesn't rain. Therefore, you can make wooden boom Yagis with coat hanger wire and so on, and the square loop is a convenient way of feeding an antenna. So, once again, whether you're building quaggy antennas, quad Yagi antennas, I mean, some of the guys on 432 experimented with me way back in the late 70s where they were building multiple element long Yagis where all of the elements were cubical quad as opposed to dipoles. The bottom line is they did not see extra gain. Everyone believed they did. Did they get a little bit extra bandwidth? Maybe so, but it's not worth a whole... You choose the method of construction that you like and the materials that you like, and if you want to do it that way, go ahead. But when it comes to the water droplets collecting on the end of the elements, detuning the antenna on 6 meters, you will not see any of that unless you make the elements out of, 1/8-inch diameter wire, which you're not going to do because the birds would be bent.
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Yeah, you're not going to be doing that because the birds would be bending up the antenna element something fierce. So lots of people believe, and Wayne Oberbeck also did a great big article in Ham Radio Magazine, in which he took this 75-foot crank-up tower, put it on a trailer, towed it behind his recreation vehicle, went to all of the various big boom signals on the California coast, and he parked a mile away and measured signal strength of normal Yagi antennas and normal cubical quad antennas, looking for whether or not there really was extra gain. Of all of his measurements, the answer is, you can go to that article in Ham Radio Magazine, which if you're a QST member, if you're an ARRL member, you can go to the archives and find that article, and you'll see that there was essentially no improvement. Everyone believes the cubicle quad has more gain because you see more stuff there. Mother Nature doesn't behave that way. Her eyes don't see it quite the way you do. Maybe that helps a little bit, Bennett. KO2 OK, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KO2 OK, returning. Well, thank you, Dick. You gave me a couple of people and references to follow up on. I appreciate it. I'll do some more reading. I was just curious with this type of design. Again, just the driven element is a loop. The rest of them are just solid rod. Just curious about noise and bandwidth and so on. But appreciate it. I'm going to look up some of those references. More reading to do. Appreciate it. Have a good evening. Back to net.
Very fine, Bennett. Good luck with what you find out. Please come back and tell us what you find. Stand by for a second. Yeah, KC2RFF is the next person on. Yo, ERR. Sorry about that. Oh, I'm not very good at using my computer tonight. Still got it wrong. But go right ahead, Angel, with your question. K2LIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick. To Echo Romeo Romeo, who signed in 1.5 hours ago. Are you there, Angel? I'm going to give you one more try. KC2 Echo Romeo Romeo. K2LIW listening. Maybe Angel got called away. There was an extremely weak signal. Sounded something like KB2 Victor Bravo something. If he was able to make a change in location, or if the propagation to him improved, we'll give it a try. KB2 Victor Bravo question mark. K2LIW. Give us a brief transmission. Let's see if we're going to be able to hear you. Okay, how is the next person? November 2, Golf Oscar Tango. Hey, we may make it tonight. We may actually meet our advertising claim. KB2GOT. You got it, Howard. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, just checking in with Sporting the Net. Don't have much to add. Just been listening here a little bit to the net and enjoying it. Everybody, Dick, also have a pleasure having you on our two meter net with the Kings County Radio Club last Tuesday. And to GOT.
Yeah, good group of guys. A little bit overly enthusiastic. That was a joke. But I met these guys by going visiting a number of the field day operations a couple of years ago, and that was during the time when I was doing some high voltage research for a particular client, and I had some of these high voltage generating machines, a Wimhurst machine. I brought one along, and so the Kings County Radio Club got a chance to see that thing in operation. It's kind of exciting, and that got me asking questions about why does air act that way when you get a high voltage spark, and this machine is capable of making a spark that'll jump a gap of 3 3/4 inches. Takes about 150,000 volts at a very low current to do that, and it's an exciting thing to watch and wonder why air breakdown behaves that way. So lots of discussions have occurred over the years over that one. Okay, I think we've gone down the list of everyone who signed in. Let me do a double check to make sure I haven't left anyone out. K2LIW in the TechNet. Okay, Mel, we're a little bit ahead of schedule, and go right ahead with your mailbag. K2 Kilo Echo Yankee, K2LIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. All right, I'm just reading through them and trying to get through all this stuff. There's so much here, and I don't, let me see if I can find a question that doesn't pertain to, as you say, repeat a politics. All right, let me see. Oh, okay, here's one. I was given a present, an old Gonsant linear amplifier, HF linear. Oh, I remember that one well. And I noticed when I hook it to my transceiver, the power folds back on the transceiver. I inserted an SWR bridge between the transceiver and the amplifier, and found that the amplifier shows a 3-to-1 SWR. What is wrong? What am I missing? Nobody seems to be able to answer that. Well, I think I could give you a basic idea of what to do, but what would you suggest, Dick? Over.
Mel, you're more of an HF operator than I am. I'd like you to give the answer first, and I'll give a couple of guesses as to what I think might be going on. But I haven't been there as much. By the way, in my opinion, many of these afterburners, your Heathkit SB200 and 220 and your Cushcraft, not Cushcraft, I'm trying to think of some of the other brand names. Anyhow, back in the days when tube amplifiers were very popular, most of us in those days were also using tube exciters, you know, a DX100, a Collins receiver or transceiver or whatever, which had a real tuning and loading control to the final stage of the exciter, the thing that starts over the transmitter before the afterburner. And as such, those things had a very large tuning range capability. A 3-to-1 to them was nothing. To match that was easy. So therefore, in my opinion, the manufacturers of amplifiers in that day didn't worry about the exact input impedance of the amplifier. The tube health has got a little bit of a factor, but they didn't work real hard on it. Nowadays, that we've got these so-called no-tune rigs, where if you don't have a 1.5-to-1 standing wave ratio or better, they're going to start going into the protect mode, self-protect mode, and start cutting back in power or turning themselves off or whatever. And as such, now you've got a much higher performance requirement for the input impedance of your amplifier. It's achievable, but you may have to work at it. and it may be asking for something that originally was not designed into the amplifier because in the old days it wasn't required. That's some guesses on my part. K2KEY, K2RIW.
That's very definite. Well, I'm somewhat familiar with that amplifier. It was a very popular amplifier back in the days when the company called Johnson was a popular manufacturer of equipment. In fact, they really did start the great interest in 6 meters with their communicators and, of course, 2 meters, the famous 2 meter Johnson communicator that was, oh my God, they must have made them in the hundreds of thousands. They were so popular. And they used to be called, well, as a little, you know, sort of funny name we gave them called the Goonie Box back in them days. Goonie Boxes. All right. It was an early bird transceiver, believe it or not, a 2 meter full transceiver in one box with a separate receiver tuning and separate transmitter tuning. A crystal control transmitter, but you could add a VFO. That was basically the layout of those rigs. Now, they did produce a number of amplifiers, and one of the amplifiers they did make is an HF amplifier. The HF amplifier had what is known as a, I mean, let's drop and I'll describe the what the problem usually was. Okay, the HF amplifier had what was known as a tuned input. In other words, as you went from band to band, there was a circuit that you actually loaded into that consisted of a inductor and a capacitor. Over years, I've seen a number of those, not only Gonson amplifiers, a number of them, where the conditions have changed that the input tuning networks have to be reset. In other words, redipped. How you can prove this was very simple. You take a tuner, standard antenna tuner, and you put it between the transceiver and the input of the amplifier, and you can now tune it so that you will not get that foldback on your transceiver. However, it's not still going to fix the SWR situation with the amplifier, but it just will show you that that is the problem. If you can now get the transceiver to show that it's putting so-called full power in via the tuner, then you know you have to get in there and tweak it. I know if you don't put a full 100 watts into that amplifier, you will not be able to get this so-called power output of 100 watts stick over.
In the case of a grounded grid final afterburner type amplifier, I believe that the input impedance doesn't change very much as you change drive level. If you go from the 10 watt to the 50 watt to the 100 watt drive level and get that essentially full power output, I think there's a rather minor change of input impedance. There's another kind of amplifier where it's running grounded cathode and you're feeding the control grid, and now you will see a substantial difference in input impedance as a function of drive level. But in all cases, using the antenna tuner, as Mel recommended, allows you, in theory, as long as your antenna tuner controls do not run out of range for that particular frequency band you're on, you can accomplish a nearly perfect impedance match between the exciter and the final amplifier, and essentially all the power is now being transferred because a well-designed antenna tuner runs ice cold, is well-shielded, it wastes zero power. You say those words on the 20-meter band on a Saturday afternoon, and a bunch of people will give you a lot of flack. They don't believe it. They believe antenna tuners are phony, that they really are snake oil, and all they're doing is taking the reflected power from the antenna and throwing it away. Absolutely, positively, not true. An antenna tuner gives you a perfect impedance match. It takes all that reflected power, re-reflects it forward toward the antenna in phase with the power coming out of your transmitter right now. And therefore, the voltage and the apparent forward power increases, and the antenna gets a chance to radiate it all, or your final amplifier gets a chance to absorb it all. So antenna tuners are a beautiful thing. The Pi networks we used to have in our older rigs were the antenna tuner. And now that we insist on no-tune rigs, they're more compact, all of that circuitry has been removed, but now they're giving it back to you, selling it back like a not-so-scrumptious unscrupulous contractor who wipes out all the topsoil, builds you a house, and then sells you your topsoil back so that you can build a lawn.
Repeater, time out, cancel.
So to a small degree, we've paid the price, so to speak. We've got a more compact rig now that they're no-tune, transistorized, nice small rigs that are good for mobile operation or whatever. But they don't have the tuning and loading controls we used to have. And so in many cases, you need it, depending on what you're using for an antenna. So readjusting the input network, if it's a grounded grid final amplifier tube circuit, for instance, and there's either a resonating capacitor or a tapped coil or whatever on that cathode circuit coming from the input connector to the cathode of the tube, by readjusting the components in that tuning network for that particular band, you will be able to get a perfect impedance match at your particular drive level. But because the original manufacturer didn't have to do that, because the exciters in the old days used to have a lot more tuning range, you're going to be modifying the original design. And that's not bad. There are guys who think that if they take the top cover off of their final amplifier, that they're going to be voiding the warranty of this piece of 15-year-old equipment, and they act as if there's a scorpion inside with 15 years worth of food, and they're going to be subjected to that. We as amateurs, as long as you're careful about high voltages and whatever, taking the top cover off and modifying our equipment, we do that all the time. Do some checking with your whoever you think is the local expert before you get yourself in trouble. And as I said, obey some real good conservative techniques with reference to high voltage when you're doing this. But modifying the circuit, I'll bet you know lots of people who have done it. Isn't that true, Mel? K2KEY, K2LIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Well, you got to remember that these amplifiers especially were put together with a lot of surplus parts. This was into the late, 50s, 60s, yeah, I'd say in the 50s, early 60s. There was a lot of surplus parts around, and the choice of a lot of the amplifiers at that time was a couple of tubes that were very inexpensive, so that you could produce an amplifier and sell it for, well, you would scratch your head today and say impossible, but it was a couple of $100s, and you got a lot for your buck, as they say. But because the tubes in it were happened to be a tubes called the 813s, 813s, they were very popular tubes, and you'd buy them for, I've seen them at lower price, the lowest price I ever saw 813s were literally about 75 cents a piece, brand new surplus. There were tons of them around, and a number of other tubes around, so what happened was they became very popular, but they found that the 813 did work better with what was known as a tuned cathode circuit, and so that's why you had those networks, Dick, and those amplifiers over.
If you've ever seen an 813 tube, it is a beautiful thing. It stands about 8 inches tall. It's probably about 3 inches in diameter. It has a huge anode structure, a plate structure, that's made out of carbon. So you get this great big black structure that when you're using the tube at full blast power output, that carbon anode, that carbon plate circuit, will glow red in the center when you're really pushing the tube. I think that plate circuit of the tube can dissipate either 300 or 500 watts per tube. A pair of 813s running push-pull or parallel, I believe, is capable of a full gallon, a conservative full gallon, as an afterburner amplifier. I think it requires something like 3,500 volts on the plate, and I believe the tube is a tetrode. I think it's got a screen grid, and it's got quite a bit of gain, a really beautiful tube. As long as you don't abuse it, they're very rugged. And nowadays, I bet you they're a fortune, but in your and my day, Mel and I go back to the middle 50s when we cut our teeth on ham radio in our teen years, the early teen years, and 813s were fairly popular tubes then for guys who were building high-power amplifiers. I bet you've seen some of those at flea markets and that at some awful nice prices. I bet you you own an amplifier with at least a pair of 813s. K2KEY, K2RIW.